Welcome to today's Book Hour. The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the eighth reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that the book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, Friedrich was pointed out as the weakest cadet by another cadet named Rodel. When he failed to reach the commandant before being caught by the fastest cadets, he was beaten with a rubber hose by Rodel under the supervision of the commandant. Werner was upset with himself for doing nothing. Marie-Laure's father, having completed the model of Saint-Malo, received a telegram directing him to return to Paris. Outside of Vitry, her father was seized by the police. After 4 days, he and the other prisoners were transported to Germany. Back in 1944, Sergeant Major von Rumpel, suffering from severe glandular problems, watched Number 4 Rue Vaubray as Saint-Malo burns. Marie-Laure, with the model of the home on Rue Vaubray containing the stone, took the last remaining half loaf of bread into the cellar. When she had finally finished eating it, she found 2 cans of what she hopes is food. Von Rumpel approached Number 4 Rue Vaubray. In the cellar of the Hotel of Bees, Werner, Volkheimer, and Bernd continue to barely survive. Marie-Laure left the cellar and got a large knife and a brick and went to the 3rd floor, drank water from the bathtub, and then heard the tripwire. Someone had entered the house. January 1941, and Werner and Friedrich are going to Friedrich's home in Berlin during the January recess, as we now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. Friedrich leads them into a 5-story townhouse 1 block off a pretty avenue called the Nessenbeckerstrasse. He rings number 2, and a returning buzz echoes from inside and the door unlatches. They come into a dim foyer and stand before a pair of matched doors. Friedrich presses a button, and something high in the building rattles, and Werner whispers, "You have an elevator." Friedrich smiles. The machinery clangs downward, and the lift clanks into place, and Friedrich pushes the wooden doors inward. Werner watches the interior of the building slide past in amazement. When they reach the 2nd floor, he says, "Can we ride it again?" Friedrich laughs. They go down, back up, down, up, to the lobby a 4th time, and Werner is peering into the cables and weights above the car, trying to understand its mechanism, when a tiny woman enters the building and shakes out her umbrella. With her other hand, she carries a paper sack, and her eyes rapidly apprehend the boys' uniforms and the intense whiteness of Werner's hair and the livid bruises beneath Friedrich's eyes. On the breast of her coat, a mustard yellow star has been carefully stitched, perfectly straight, 1 vertex down, another up. Drops fall like seeds from the tip of her umbrella.
"Good afternoon, Frau Schwarzenberger," says Friedrich.
He backs up against the wall of the elevator car and gestures for her to enter. She squeezes into the lift, and Werner steps in behind her. From the top of her sack jets a sheaf of withered greens. Her collar, he can see, is separating from the rest of the coat. Threads are giving way. If she were to turn, their eyes would be a hand's width apart. Friedrich presses 2, then 5. No one speaks. The old woman rubs the trembling tip of an index finger across 1 eyebrow. The lift clangs up 1 floor. Friedrich snaps open the cage, and Werner follows him out. He watches the old woman's gray shoes rise past his nose. Already the door to number 2 is opening, and an aproned woman with baggy arms and a downy face rushes out and embraces Friedrich. She kisses him on both cheeks, then touches his bruises with her thumbs.
It's all right, Franny. Horseplay.
The apartment is sleek and shiny, full of deep carpets that swallow noise. Big rear windows look out into the hearts of four leafless lindens, sleet still falling outside.
Mother isn't home yet, Franny says,
smoothing down her apron with both palms. Her eyes stay on Friedrich.
You're sure you're all right?
Friedrich says,
of course.
And together he and Werner pad into a warm, clean-smelling bedroom, and Friedrich slides open a drawer, and when he turns around, he's wearing eyeglasses with black frames. He looks at Werner shyly.
Oh, come on, you didn't already know?
With his glasses on, Friedrich's expression seems to ease. His face makes more sense. This, Werner thinks, is who he is. A soft-skinned boy in glasses with taffy-colored hair and the finest trace of a mustache needled across his lip. Bird lover. Rich kid.
I barely hit anything in marksmanship. You really didn't know?
Maybe, says Werner.
Maybe I knew. How did you pass the eye exams?
Memorize the charts.
Don't they have different ones?
I memorized all four. Father got them ahead of time. Mother helped me study.
What about your binoculars?
The prescription cost a fortune.
They sit in a big kitchen at a butcher's block with a marble cap. The maid named Franny emerges with a dark loaf and a round of cheese, and she smiles at Friedrich as she sets it down. They talk about Christmas and how Friedrich was sorry to miss it, and the maid passes out through a swinging door and returns with two white plates, so delicate that they ring when she sets them down. Werner's mind reels. A lift? A Jewish? A maid? Berlin? They retreat into Friedrich's bedroom, which is populated with tin soldiers and model airplanes and wooden crates full of comic books. They lie on their stomachs and page through comics, feeling the pleasure of being outside of school, glancing at each other now and then as if curious to learn whether their friendship will continue to exist in another place. Franny calls,
I'm going!
And as soon as the door closes, Friedrich takes Werner by the arm into the living room and climbs a ladder built along a tall hardwood shelves and slides aside a large wicker basket and from behind it brings down a huge book. Two volumes, enfolded in golden slipcovers, each as big as a crib mattress.
Here, his voice glows, his eyes glows. This is what I wanted to show you.
Inside are lush, full-color paintings of birds. Two white falcons swoop over each other, beaks open. A blood-red flamenco holds its black-tipped beak over stagnant water. Resplendent geese stand on a headland and peer into a heavy sky. Friedrich turns the pages with both hands. Pipiary flycatcher, buff-breasted merganser, red-cockaded woodpecker, many of them larger in the book than in real life.
Audubon, Friedrich says, was an American. Walked the swamps and woods for years, back when the whole country was just swamps and woods. He'd spend all day watching one individual bird. Then he'd shoot it and prop it up with wires and sticks and paint it. Probably knew more than any birder before or since. He'd eat most of the birds after he'd painted them. Can you imagine?
Friedrich's voice trembles with ardency. Gazing up,
those bright mists and your gun on your shoulder and your eyes set firmly in your head.
Werner tries to see what Friedrich sees. A time before photography, before binoculars. And here was someone willing to tramp out into a wilderness, brimming with the unknown, and bring back paintings. A book not so much full of birds as full of effervescence, of blue wing, trumpeting mysteries. He thinks of the Frenchman's radio program, of Heinrich Hertz's Principles of Mechanics. Doesn't he recognize the thrill in Friedrich's voice? He says,
my sister would love this.
Father says we're not supposed to have it. Says we have to keep it hidden up there behind the basket because it's American and was printed in Scotland. It's just birds.
The front door opens and footsteps clack across the foyer. Friedrich hurries the volumes back inside their slipcovers. He calls, Mazer! And a woman wearing a green ski suit with white stripes down the legs enters crying.
Freddy! Freddy!
She embraces her son and holds him back with straight arms while she runs a fingertip over a mostly healed cut along his forehead. Friedrich looks off over her shoulder with a trace of panic on his face. Is he afraid that she'll see he was looking at the forbidden book, or that she'll be angry about his bruises? She does not say anything, but merely stares at her son, tangled in thoughts Werner cannot guess, then remembers herself.
And you must be Werner.
The smile sweeps back onto her face.
Friedrich has written lots about you. Look at that hair. Oh, we adore guests.
She climbs the ladder and restores the heavy Audubon volumes to their shelf one at a time, as though putting away something irritating. The three of them sit at the vast oak table, and Werner thanks her for the train ticket, and she tells a story about a man she ran into just now, unbelievable, really, who apparently is a famous tennis player, and every now and then she reaches across and squeezes Friedrich's forearm.
You would have been absolutely amazed, she said more than once,
and Werner studies his friend's face to gauge whether or not he would have been amazed. And Franny returns to set out wine and more rucas, and for an hour Werner forgets about Schopforta, about Bastian and the black rubber hose, about the Jewess upstairs, the things these people have, a violin on a stand in the corner, and sleek furniture made from chromium steel, and a brass telescope, and a sterling silver chess set behind glass, and this magnificent cheese that tastes like smoke has been stirred into butter. Wine glows sleepily in Werner's stomach, and sleet ticks down through the lindens when Friedrich's mother announces that they are going out.
Tighten up your ties, won't you?
She applies powder beneath Friedrich's eyes, and they walk to a bistro, the kind of restaurant Werner has never dreamed of entering, and a boy in a white jacket, barely older than they are, brings more wine. A constant stream of diners come to their table to shake Werner's and Friedrich's hands and ask how Friedrich's mother, in low syncopatic voices, about her husband's latest advancement. Werner notices a girl in the corner, radiant, dancing by herself, throwing her face to the ceiling, eyes closed. The food is rich, and every now and then Friedrich's mother laughs, and Friedrich absently touches the makeup on his face, while his mother says,
Well, Freddy has all the best there at that school, all the best.
And seemingly every minute some new face comes along and kisses Friedrich's mother on both cheeks and whispers in her ear. When Werner overhears Friedrich's mother say to a woman,
Oh, the Schwarzenberger Kron will be gone by year's end. Then we'll have the top floor, du wirst schon sehen.
He glances at Friedrich, whose smudged eyeglasses have gone opaque in the candlelight, whose makeup looks strange and lewd now, as though it has intensified the bruises rather than concealed them, and a feeling of great uneasiness overtakes him. He hears Rodel swing the hose, the smack of it across Friedrich's unflung palms. He hears the voices of the boys in his Kameradschaft back in Zollverein sing, Live faithfully, fight bravely, and die laughing. The bistro is overcrowded. Everyone's mouths move too quickly. The woman talking to Friedrich's mother is wearing a nauseating quantity of perfume. And in the watery light, it seems suddenly as if the scarf trailing from the dancing girl's neck is a noose. Friedrich says,
Are you all right?
Fine. It's delicious.
But Werner feels something inside him screw tighter, tighter. On the way home, Friedrich and his mother walk ahead. She loops her slender arm through his and talks to him in a low voice. Freddy this, Freddy that. The street is empty, the windows dead,
The electric signs switched off. Innumerable shops, millions sleeping in beds around them. And yet, where are they all? As they reach Friedrich's block, a woman in a dress leaning against a building bends over and vomits on the sidewalk. In the townhouse, Friedrich pulls on pajamas made of jelly green silk and folds his glasses on the nightstand and climbs barefoot into his brass childhood bed. Werner gets into a trundle bed that Friedrich's mother has apologized for 3 separate times, although its mattress is more comfortable than any he has slept on in his life. The building falls quiet. Model airplanes glimmer on Friedrich's shelves.
"Do you ever wish," whispers Werner, "that you didn't have to go back? Baza needs me to be at the shop for the mother, too. Doesn't matter what I want." "Of course it matters. I want to be an engineer, and you want to study birds. Be like that American painter in the swamps. Why else do any of this if not to become who we want to be?"
A stillness in the room. Out there in the trees beyond Friedrich's window hangs an alien light.
"Your problem, Werner," says Friedrich, "is that you still believe you own your life."
When Werner awakes, it's well past dawn. His head aches and his eyeballs feel heavy. Friedrich is already dressed, wearing trousers, an iron shirt, and a necktie, kneeling against a window with his nose against the glass.
"Greifswald," he points.
Werner looks past him into the naked lindens.
"Doesn't look like much, does he?" murmurs Friedrich. "Hardly a couple of ounces of feathers and bones. But that bird can fly to Africa and back, powered by bugs and worms and desire."
The wagtail hops from twig to twig. Werner rubs his aching eyes. It's just a bird.
10,000 years ago, whispers Friedrich, "they came through here in the millions. Then this place was a garden, one endless garden from end to end."
He is not coming back. Marie-Laure wakes and thinks she hears the shuffle of Papa's shoes, the clink of his key ring. 4th floor, 5th floor, 6th. His fingers brush the doorknob. His body radiates a faint but palpable heat in the chair beside her. His little tools rasp across wood. He smells of glue and sandpaper and Gratz's bleus, but it is only the house groaning, the sea throwing foam against rocks, deceits of the mind. On the 12th morning, without any word from her father, Marie-Laure does not get out of bed. She no longer cares that her great-uncle put on an ancient necktie and stood by the front door on 2 separate occasions and whispered weird rhymes to himself.
"A la pomme de terre, je suis par terre, oh, encore je suis dans l'eau,"
trying and failing to summon the courage to go out. She no longer begs Madame Manek to take her to the train station, to write another letter, to spend another futile afternoon at the prefecture trying to petition occupation authorities to locate her father. She becomes unreachable, sullen. She does not bathe, does not warm herself by the kitchen fire, ceases to ask if she can go outdoors. She hardly eats.
"The museum says they're searching, child,"
whispers Madame Manek, but when she tries to press her lips to Marie-Laure's forehead, the girl jerks backward as if burned. The museum replies to Etienne's appeals. They report that Marie-Laure's father never arrived.
"Never arrived?"
says Etienne aloud. This becomes the question that drags its teeth through Marie-Laure's mind. Why didn't he make it to Paris? If he couldn't, why didn't he return to Saint-Malo?
"I will never leave you, not in 1,000,000 years.
She wants only to go home, to stand in their 4-room flat and hear the chestnut tree rustle outside her window, hear the cheese seller raise his awning, feel her father's fingers close around hers. If only she had begged him to stay. Now everything in the house scares her. the creaking stairs, shuttered windows, empty rooms, the clutter and silence. Etienne tries performing silly experiments to cheer her. A vinegar volcano, a tornado in a bottle.
Can you hear it, Marie, spinning in there?
She does not feign interest. Madame Manette brings her omelets, cassoulet, bruchet of fish, fabricating miracles out of ration tickets and the dregs of her cupboards. But Marie-Laure refuses to eat.
Like a snail, she overhears Etienne say outside her door, curled up so tight in there.
But she is angry at Etienne for doing so little, at Madame Manette for doing so much, at her father for not being here to help her understand his absence, at her eyes for failing her, at everything and everyone. Who knew love could kill you? She spends hours kneeling by herself on the sixth floor with the window open and the sea hurling arctic air into the room, her fingers on the model of Saint Malo slowly going numb. South to the gate of Dinan, west to the Plage du Mont, back to the Rue Vaubray. Every second Etienne's house grows colder. Every second it feels as if her father slips further away. Prisoner. One February morning, the cadets are roused from their beds at 2 a.m. and driven out into the glitter. In the center of the quadrangle, torches burn. Keg-chested Bastien waddles out with his bare legs showing beneath his coat. Frank Volkheimer emerges from the shadows, dragging a tattered and skeletal man in mismatched shoes. Volkheimer sets him down beside the commandant, where a stake has been driven into the snow. Methodically, Volkheimer ties the man's torso to the stake. A vault of stars hang overhead. The collective breath of the cadets mingles slowly, nightmarishly, above the courtyard. Volkheimer retreats. The commandant paces.
You boys would not believe what a creature this is. What a foul beast, a centaur, an untermensch.
Everyone cranes to see. The prisoner's ankles are cuffed and his arms bound from wrists to forearms. His thin shirt has split at the seams, and he gazes into some middle distance with hypothermic slackness. He looks Polish, Russian maybe. Despite his fetters, he manages to sway lightly back and forth. Bastien says,
"This man escaped from a work camp. Tried to violate a farmhouse and steal a liter of fresh milk. He was stopped before he could do something more nefarious."
He gestures vaguely beyond the walls.
"This barbarian would tear out your throat in a second if we let him."
Since the visit to Berlin, a great dread has been blooming inside Werner's chest. It came gradually, as slow-moving as the sun's passage across the sky. But now he finds himself writing letters to Jutta in which he must skirt the truth, must contend that everything is fine when things do not feel fine. He descends into dreams in which Friedrich's mother mutates into a leering small-mouthed demon and lowers Dr. Hauptmann's triangles over his head. 1,000 frozen stars preside over the quad. The cold is invasive, mindless.
"This look," Bastien says and flourishes his fat hand. "The way he's got nothing left. A German soldier never reaches this point. There's a name for this look. It's called circling the drain."
The boys try not to shiver. The prisoner blinks down at the scene as if from a very high perch. Volkheimer returns carrying a clattering raft of buckets. Two other seniors uncoil a water hose across the quadrangle. Bastien explains, first the instructors, then upperclassmen. Everyone will file past and soak the prisoner with a bucket of water. Every man in the school. They start. One by one, each instructor takes a full bucket from Volkheimer and flings its contents at the prisoner a few feet away. Cheers rise into the frozen night. At the first two or three dowsings, the prisoner comes awake, rocking back on his heels.
Vertical creases appear between his eyes. He looks like someone trying to remember something vital. Among the instructors in their dark capes, Dr. Hauptmann goes past, his gloved fingers pinching his collar around his throat. Hauptmann accepts his bucket and throws a sheet of water and doesn't linger to watch it land. The water keeps coming. The prisoner's face empties. He slumps over the ropes propping him up, and his torso slides down the stake, and every now and then Volkheimer comes out of the shadows, looming fantastically huge, and the prisoner straightens again. The upperclassmen vanish inside the castle. The buckets make a muted, frozen clanking as they are refilled. The 16-year-olds finish. The 15-year-olds finish. The cheers lose their gusto, and a pure longing to flee floods Werner. Run, run. 3 boys tell his turn. 2 boys. Werner tries to float images in front of his eyes, but the only ones that come are wretched. The hauling machine above Pit 9, the hunched miners walking as if they drag the weight of enormous chains, the boy from the entrance exams trembling before he fell. Everyone trapped in their roles, orphans, cadets, Friedrich, Volkheimer, the old Jewess who lives upstairs, even Jutta. When his turn arrives, Werner throws the water like all the others, and the splash hits the prisoner in the chest, and a perfunctory cheer rises. He joins the cadets waiting to be released. Wet boots, wet cuffs, his hands have become so numb they do not seem his own. 5 boys later, it is Friedrich's turn. Friedrich, who clearly cannot see well without his glasses, who has not been cheering when each bucketful of water finds its mark, who is frowning at the prisoner as though he recognizes something there, and Werner knows what Friedrich is going to do. Friedrich has to be nudged forward by the boy behind him. The upperclassman hands him a bucket, and Friedrich pours it out on the ground. Bastian steps forward. His face flares scarlet in the cold. Give him another! Again, Friedrich sloshes it onto the ice at his feet. He says in a small voice, He is already finished, sir. The upperclassman hands over a third pail. Throw it! Commands Bastian. The night steams, the stars burn, the prisoner sways, the boys watch, the commandant tilts his head. Friedrich pours the water onto the ground. I will not. Plage de Mol. Marie-Laure's father has been missing without word for 29 days. She wakes to find Madame Manek's blocky pumps climbing to the third floor, the fourth, the fifth. Etienne's voice on the landing outside his study. Don't.
You all know. She is my responsibility.
Some unexpected steel emerges in Manek's voice.
I cannot stand by one moment longer.
She climbs the last flight. Marie-Laure's door creaks open. The old woman crosses the floor and places her heavy boned hand on Marie-Laure's forehead.
You're awake.
Marie-Laure rolls herself onto the corner and speaks through linens.
Yes, madame.
I'm taking you out. Bring your cane.
Marie-Laure dresses herself. Madame Manek meets her at the bottom of the stairs with a heel of bread. She ties a scarf over Marie-Laure's head, buttons her coat all the way to the collar, and opens the front door. Morning in late February, and the air smells rainy and calm. Marie-Laure hesitates, listening. Her heart beats 2, 4, 6, 8.
Hardly anyone is out yet, dear, whispers Madame Manek, and we are doing nothing wrong.
The gate creaks.
One step down, now straight on. That's it.
The cobbled street presses up irregularly against Marie-Laure's shoes. The tip of her cane catches, vibrates, catches again. A light rain falls on rooftops, trickles through runnels, beads up on her scarf. Sound ricochets between the high houses. She feels, as she did in her first hour here, as if she has stepped into a maze. Far above them, someone shakes a duster out a window. A cat mewls. What terrors gnash their teeth out here? What was Papa so anxious to protect her from? They make one turn, then a second, and then Madame Manek steers her left, where Marie Laure does not expect her to, where the city walls, furried with moss, have been scrolling along unbroken, and they're stepping through a gateway.
Madame?
They pass out of the city.
Stairs here, mind yourself. One down, two, there you are, easy as cake.
The ocean, right in front of her, so close all this time. It sucks and booms and splashes and rumbles. It shifts and dilates and falls over itself. The labyrinth of St. Malo has opened onto a portal of sound larger than anything she has ever experienced. Larger than the Jardin des Plantes, than the Seine, larger than the grandest galleries of the museum. She did not imagine it properly. She did not comprehend the scale. When she raises her face to the sky, she can feel the thousand tiny spines of raindrops melt onto her cheeks, her forehead. She hears Madame Manek's raspy breathing and the deep sounding of the sea among the rocks and the calls of someone down the beach echoing off the high walls. In her mind, she can hear her father polishing locks, Dr. Giffard walking along the rows of his drawers. Why didn't they tell her it would be like this?
That's Monsieur Radam calling his dog, says Madame Manek. Nothing to worry about. Here's my arm. Sit down and take off your shoes. Roll up your coat sleeves.
Marie Laure does as she's told.
Are they watching?
The Boches? So what if they are? An old woman and a girl. I'll tell them we're digging clams. What can they do?
Uncle says they've buried bombs in the beaches.
Don't you worry about that. He is frightened of an ant.
He says the moon pulls the ocean back.
The moon?
Sometimes the sun pulls, too. He says that around the islands, the tides make funnels that can swallow boats whole.
We aren't going anywhere near there, dear. We're just on the beach.
Marie Laure unwinds her scarf, and Madame Manek takes it. Briny, weedy, pewter-colored air slips down her collar.
Madame?
Yes.
What do I do?
Just walk.
She walks. Now there are cold, round pebbles beneath her feet. Now crackling weeds. Now something smoother, wet, unwrinkled sand. She bends and spreads her fingers. It's like cold silk. Cold, sumptuous silk into which the sea has laid offerings. Pebbles, shells, barnacles. Tiny slips of wrack. Her fingers dig and reach. The drops of rain touch the back of her neck, the backs of her hands. The sand pulls the heat from her fingertips, from the soles of her feet. A months-old knot inside Marie Laure begins to loosen. She moves along the tide line, almost crawling at first, and imagines the beach stretching off in either direction, ringing the promontory, embracing the outer islands, the whole filigree tracery of the Breton coastline with its wild capes and crumbling batteries and vine-choked ruins. She imagines the walled city behind her, its soaring ramparts, its puzzle of streets, all of it suddenly as small as Papa's model. But what surrounds the model is not something her father conveyed to her. What's beyond the model is the most compelling thing. A flock of gulls squall overhead. Each of the 100,000 tiny grains of sand in her fists grinds against its neighbor. She feels her father pick her up and spin her around 3 times. No occupation soldier comes to arrest them. No one even speaks to them. In 3 hours, Marie Laure's numb fingers discover a stranded jellyfish, an encrusted buoy, 1,000 polished stones. She wades to her knees and soaks the hem of her dress. When Madame Manek finally leads her,
damp and dazzled, back to the Rue Vaubray, Marie-Laure climbs all five flights and raps on the door of Etienne's study and stands before him, wet sand stuck all over her face.
"You are gone a long time," he murmurs. "I worried."
"Here, uncle." From her pockets she brings up shells, barnacles, cowries, 13 lumps of quartz gritty with sand.
"I brought you this, and this, and this, and this."
Lapidary. In 3 months, Sergeant Major von Rumpel has traveled to Berlin and Stuttgart. He has assessed the value of 100 confiscated rings, a dozen diamond bracelets, a Latvian cigarette case in which a lozenge of blue topaz twinkled. Now back in Paris, he has slept at the Grand Hotel for a week and sent forth his queries like birds. Every night, the moment returns to him, when he clasped that pear-shaped diamond between his thumb and forefinger, made huge by the lens of his loop, and believed he held the 133-carat sea of flames. He stared into the stone's ice-blue interior, where miniature mountain ranges seemed to send back fire, crimsons and corals and violets, polygons of color twinkling and coruscating as he rotated it. And he almost convinced himself that the stories were true, that centuries ago a sultan's son wore a crown that blinded visitors, that the keeper of the diamond could never die, that the fabled stone had caromed down through the pegs of history and dropped into his palm. There was joy in that moment, triumph, but an unexpected fear mixed with it. The stone looked like something enchanted, not meant for human eyes, an object that, once looked at, could never be forgotten. But eventually reason won out. The joints of the diamond's facets were not quite as sharp as they should have been, the girdle just slightly waxy. More telling, the stone betrayed no delicate cracks, no pinpoints, not a single inclusion. A real diamond, his father used to say, is never entirely free of inclusions. A real diamond is never perfect. Had he expected it to be real, to be kept precisely where he wished it would be, to win such a victory in a single day? Of course not. One might think von Rumpel would be frustrated, but he is not. On the contrary, he feels quite hopeful. The museum would never have commissioned such a high-quality fake if they did not possess the real thing somewhere. Over the past weeks in Paris, in the hours between other tasks, he has narrowed a list of 7 lapidaries to 3, then to 1, a half-Algerian named Dupont, who came of age cutting opal. It appears Dupont was making money before the war by faceting spinels into false diamonds for dowagers and baronesses, also for museums. One Friday midnight, von Rumpel lets himself into Dupont's fastidious shop not far from Sacré-Cœur. He examines a copy of Streeter's precious stones and gems, drawings of cleavage panes, trigonometric charts used for faceting. When he finds several painstaking iterations of a model that match exactly the size and pear-cut shape of the stone in the vault at the museum, he knows he has his man. At von Rumpel's request, Dupont is furnished with forged food ration tickets. Now von Rumpel waits. He prepares his questions. Did you make other replicas? How many? Do you know who has them now? On the last day of February, 1941, a dapper little Gestapo man comes to him with the news that the unwitting Dupont has tried to use the forged tickets. He has been arrested. Kinderlich, child's play. It's an attractive and dazzling winter night. Scrapes of melting snow shored up against the edges of the Place de la Concorde, the city looking ghostly, its windows jeweled with raindrops. A close-cropped corporal checks von Rumpel's identification and points him not to a cell, but to a high-ceilinged,
third-story office where a typist sits behind a desk. On the wall behind her, a painted wisteria vine frays into a tangled modernist spray of color that makes Von Rumpel uneasy. Dupont is cuffed to a cheap dining chair in the center of the room. His face has the color and polish of tropical wood. Von Rumpel expected a mélange of fear and indignation and hunger, but Dupont sits upright. One of the lenses of his eyeglasses is already fractured, but otherwise he looks well enough. The typist twists her cigarette into an ashtray, a bright red smear of lipstick on its butt. The ashtray full, 50 stubs squashed in there, limbless, somehow gory. "You can go," says Von Rumpel, nodding at her, and levels his attention on the lapidary.
"He cannot speak German, sir."
"We will be fine," he says in French. "Shut the door, please."
Dupont looks up, some gland within him leeching courage into his blood. Von Rumpel does not have to force the smile. It comes easily enough. He hopes for names, but all he needs is a number. "Dearest Marie-Laure, we are in Germany now, and it is fine. I've managed to find an angel who will try to get this to you. The winter firs and alders are very beautiful here, and you are not going to believe this, but you will have to trust me. They serve us wonderful food. First class. Quail and duck and stewed rabbit, chicken legs and potatoes fried with bacon and apricot tarts, boiled beef with carrots, coq au vin on rice, plum tarts, fruits and creme glacée, as much as we can eat. I so look forward to the meals. Be polite to your uncle and madame, too. Thank them for reading this to you, and know that I am always with you, that I am right beside you. Your papa." Entropy. For a week, the dead prisoner remains strapped to the stake in the courtyard, his flesh frozen gray. Boys stop and ask the corpse directions. Someone dresses him in a cartridge belt and helmet. After several days, a pair of crows take to standing on his shoulders, chiseling away with their beaks, and eventually the custodian comes out with two third-year boys, and they hack the corpse's feet out of the ice with a maul and tip him onto a cart and roll him away. 3 times in 9 days, Friedrich is chosen as the weakest in field exercises. Bastien walks out further than ever and counts more quickly than ever, so that Friedrich has to run 400 or 500 yards, often through deep snow, and the boys race after him as if their lives depend on it. Each time he is caught. Each time he is drubbed while Bastien looks on. Each time Werner does nothing to stop it. Friedrich lasts 7 blows before falling, then 6, then 3. He never cries out and never asks to leave, and this, in particular, seems to make the commandant quake with homicidal frustration. Friedrich's dreaminess, his otherness, is on him like a scent, and everyone can smell it. Werner tries to lose himself in his work in Hauptmann's lab. He has constructed a prototype of their transceiver and tests fuses and valves and handsets and plugs. But even in those late hours, it is as if the sky has dimmed and the school has become a darker, ever more diabolical place. His stomach bothers him. He gets diarrhea. He wakes in distant quarters of the night and sees Friedrich in his bedroom in Berlin, wearing his eyeglasses and necktie, freeing trapped birds from the pages of a massive book. "You're a smart boy. You'll do well." One evening, when Hauptmann is down the hall in his office, Werner glances over at imperious, sleepy Volkheimer in the corner and says, "That prisoner..." Volkheimer blinks, stone turning to flesh. "They do that every year." He takes off his cap and runs one hand over the dense stubble of his hair. "They say he's a Pole, a Red, a Cossack. He stole liquor or kerosene or money. Every year it's the same." Under the seams of the hour, boys struggle in 12 different arenas. 400 children crawling along the edge of a razor. Always the same phrase, too, Volkheimer adds, circling the drain.
But was it decent to leave him out there like that, even after he was dead?
Decency does not matter to them. Then Hauptmann's crisp boot heels come clicking into the room, and Volkheimer leans back into the corner, and his eye sockets refill with shadow, and Werner does not have the chance to ask him which them he means. Boys leave dead mice in Friedrich's boots. They call him a poof, blowjob, countless other juvenile sobriquets. Twice, a fifth-year takes Friedrich's field glasses and smears the lenses with excrement. Werner tells himself that he tries. Every night, he polishes Friedrich's boots for him until they shine a foot deep. One less reason for a bunkmaster or Bastion or an upperclassman to jump on him. Sunday mornings in the refectory, they sit quietly in a sunbeam and Werner helps him with his schoolwork. Friedrich whispers that in the spring, he hopes to find skylark nests in the grasses outside the school walls. Once he lifts his pencil and stares into space and says, "Lesser spotted woodpecker," and Werner hears a bird's distant thrumming travel across the grounds and through the wall. In technical sciences, Dr. Hauptmann introduces the laws of thermodynamics. Entropy. Who can say what that is? The boys hunch over their desks. No one raises a hand. Hauptmann stalks the rows. Werner tries not to twitch a single muscle. Fenning!
Entropy is the degree of randomness or disorder in a system, Doctor.
His eyes fix on Werner's for a heartbeat, a glance both warm and chilling.
Disorder. You hear the commandant say that. You hear your bunkmaster say it. There must be order. Life is chaos, gentlemen, and what we represent is an ordering to that chaos, even down to the genes. We are ordering the evolution of species, winnowing out the inferior, the unruly, the chaff. This is the great project of the Reich, the greatest project human beings have ever embarked upon.
Hauptmann writes on the blackboard. The cadets inscribe the words into their composition books. The entropy of a closed system never decreases. Every process must, by law, decay. The rounds. Although Etienne continues to offer objections, Madame Manek walks Marie-Laure to the beach every morning. The girl knots her shoes herself, feels her way down the stairwell, and waits in the foyer with her cane in her fist while Madame Manek finishes up in the kitchen.
"I can find my own way," Marie-Laure says the fifth time they step out. "You don't have to lead."
22 paces to the intersection with the Rue d'Estrée, 40 more to the little gate, 9 steps down, and she's on the sand, and 20,000 sounds of the ocean engulf her. She collects pine cones dropped by trees, who knows how far away, thick hanks of rope, slick globules of stranded polyps. Once a drowned sparrow. Her greatest pleasure is to walk to the north end of the beach at low tide and squat below an island that Madame Manek calls Le Grand Bay and let her fingers whisk around in the tide pools. Only then, with her toes and fingers in the cold sea, does her mind seem to fully leave her father. Only then does she stop wondering how much of his letter was true, when he'll write again, why he has been imprisoned. She simply listens, hears, breathes. Her bedroom fills with pebbles, sea glass, shells, 40 scallops along the windowsill, 61 whelks along the top of the armoire. She arranges them by species whenever she can, then by size, smallest on the left, largest on the right. She fills jars, pails, trays. The room assumes the smell of the sea. Most mornings after the beach, she makes the rounds with Madame Manek, going to the vegetable market, occasionally to the butcher's, then delivering food, whichever neighbors Madame Manek decides are most in need. They climb an echoing stairwell, rap on a door. An old woman invites them in, asks for news, insists all three of them drink a thimbleful of sherry. Madame Manek's energy, Marie-Laure is learning, is extraordinary. She burgeons, shoots off stalks, wakes early, works late, concocts bisques without a drop of cream, loaves with less than a cup of flour. They clump together through the narrow streets, Marie-Laure's hand on the back of Madame's apron, following the odors of her stews and cakes. In such moments, Madame seems like a great moving wall of rose bushes, thorny and fragrant and crackling with bees. Still warm bread to an ancient widow named Madame Blanchard. Soup to Monsieur Saguet. Slowly, Marie-Laure's brain becomes a three-dimensional map in which exist glowing landmarks. A thick plane tree in the Place aux Herbes. 9 potted topiaries outside the Hôtel Continental. 6 stairs up a passageway called the Rue du Connectable. Several days a week, Madame brings food to crazy Harold Bazin, a veteran of the Great War who sleeps in an alcove above the library in sun or snow, who lost his nose, left an ear and eye to shellfire, who wears an enameled copper mask over half his face. Harold Bazin loves to talk about the walls and warlocks and pirates of St. Malo. Over the centuries, he tells Marie-Laure, the city ramparts have kept out bloodthirsty marauders, Romans, Celts, Norsemen, some say sea monsters. For 1,300 years, he says, the walls kept out bloodthirsty English sailors who would park their ships offshore and launch flaming projectiles at the houses, who would try to burn everything and starve everybody, who would stop at nothing to kill them all.
The mothers of St. Malo, he says, used to tell their children, sit up straight, mind your manners, or an Englishman will come in the night to cut your throat.
Harold, please, says Madame Manek, you frighten her.
In March, Etienne turns 60, and Madame Manek stews little clams, ballards, with shallots and serves them alongside mushrooms and quarters of 2 hard-boiled eggs, the only 2 eggs, she reports, she could find in the city. Etienne talks in his soft voice about the eruption of Krakatoa, how in all of his earliest memories ash from the East Indies turned the sunset over St. Malo blood red, big veins of crimson glowing above the sea every evening. And to Marie-Laure, her pockets lined with sand, her face aglow from the wind, the occupation seems, for a moment, 1,000 miles away. She misses Papa, Paris, Dr. Giffard, the gardens, her books, her pine cones, all are holes in her life. But over these past few weeks, her existence has become tolerable. At least, out on the beaches, her privation and fear are rinsed away by wind and color and light. Most afternoons, after making the morning rounds with Madame, Marie-Laure sits on her bed with the window open and travels her hands over her father's model of the city. Her fingers pass the shipbuilder's sheds on the Rue des Chartes, pass Madame Roule's bakery on the Rue Robert-Surcouf. In her imagination, she hears the baker sliding about on the flour-slick floor, moving in the way she imagines ice skaters must move, baking loaves in the same 400-year-old oven that Monsieur Roule's great-great-grandfather used. Her fingers pass the cathedral steps. Here, an old man clips roses in a garden. Here, beside the library, crazy Harold Bazin murmurs to himself as he peers with his one eye into an empty wine bottle. Here is the convent. Here, the restaurant Chez Cherche, beside the fish market. Here's number 4 Rue Vaubarais, its doors slightly recessed, where downstairs, Madame Manek kneels beside her bed, shoes off, rosary beads slipping through fingers, a prayer for practically every soul in the city. Here, in a fifth-floor room, Etienne walks beside his empty shelves, trailing his fingers over the places where his radios once stood. And somewhere beyond the borders of the model, beyond the borders of France, in a place her fingers cannot reach. Her father sits in a cell, a dozen of his whittled models on a windowsill, a guard coming toward him with what she wants very badly to believe is a feast. Quail and duck and stewed rabbit, chicken legs and potatoes fried with bacon and apricot tarts, a dozen trays, a dozen platters, as much as he can eat. Nadel in Hohofen. Midnight. Dr. Hauptmann's hounds bound through frozen fields beside the school, drops of quicksilver skittering through the white. Behind them comes Hauptmann in his fur cap, walking with short strides as though counting paces over some great distance. In the rear comes Werner, carrying the pair of transceivers he and Hauptmann have been testing for months. Hauptmann returns, his face bright.
"Nice spot here. Good sight lines. Set it down, Fanning. I've sent our friend Volkheimer ahead. He's somewhere on the hill."
Werner sees no tracks, only a humped swale of glitter in the moonlight and the white forest beyond.
"He has the KK transmitter in an ammunition box," Hauptmann says. "He is to conceal himself and broadcast steadily until we find him, or his battery dies. Even I do not know where he is."
He smacks his gloved hands together, and the dogs swirl around him, their breaths smoking.
10 square kilometers, locate the transmitter, locate our friend."
Werner looks out at the 10,000 snow-mantled trees.
"Out there, sir?" "Out there."
Hauptmann draws a flask from his pocket and unscrews it without looking at it.
"This is the fun part, Fanning."
Hauptmann stamps a clearing in the snow, and Werner sets up the first transceiver, uses measuring tape to pace off 200 meters, and sets up the second. He uncoils the grounding wires, raises the aerials, and switches them on. Already his fingers are numb.
"Try 80 meters, Fanning. Typically teams won't know what band to search, but for tonight, our first field test, we'll cheat a bit."
Werner puts on the headset and fills his ears with static. He dials up the RF gain, adjusts the filter. Before long, he has tuned in both receivers to Volkheimer's transmitter pinging along.
"I have him, sir."
Hauptmann starts smiling in earnest. The dogs caper and sneeze with excitement. From his coat, he produces a grease pencil.
"Just do it on the radio. Teams won't always have paper. Not in the field."
Werner sketches out the equation on the metal casing of the transceiver and starts plugging in numbers. Hauptmann hands him a slide rule. In 2 minutes, Werner has a vector and a distance, 2.5 kilometers.
"And the map?"
Hauptmann's little aristocratic face gleams with pleasure. Werner uses a protractor and compass to draw the lines.
"Lead on, Fanning."
Werner folds the map into his coat pocket, packs up the transceivers and carries one in each hand like matching suitcases. Tiny snow crystals sift down through the moonlight. Soon the school and its outbuildings look like toys on the white plain below. The moon slips lower, a half-lidded eye, and the dogs stick close to their master, mouth steaming, and Werner sweats.
I'm sorry to say it, but that's all the time we have, as we've come to the end of the book hour, and today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. Preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.